I'm the chair today, Senator Mary Kunesh, and with me we have Representative Cheryl Joachim, who is the chair in the House. It is May 2nd, 2023, and most importantly, today is National Teachers Day. So I thought what we would do, yes, thank you for that. I thought what we would do is maybe just go around. I know everybody loves this little exercise. Just go around and tell us who your favorite teacher was in your school year. Think for a second, and maybe we can start with Chair Joachim. We'll go this way and then come around up this way.
So my favorite teacher in high school was my journalism teacher, who really inspired me to realize that every person in the world has a story to be told. So Bev Skoglund, she was my favorite teacher. My favorite current teacher is my husband, of course.
Go ahead.
So my favorite teacher was my, I guess it was like a pre-calc teacher in high school, because he made us laugh. And I used to start falling asleep in the classroom, and he would see that and just, you know, he'd catch me. He didn't embarrass me, but he kept me awake. And then he just had this way of breaking down abstract concepts so that everybody in the class understood. So, you know, you go into classes like that with lots of anxiety. And he made us laugh. He made things comprehensible, which was his greatest gift. So I always remember him as a teacher, and I knew that I don't have those skills, so I really, really appreciate other people.
My favorite teacher was Dr. Michael Fagan. He was my first teacher of color. He was my professor at Mankato State University, and he was just filled with affirmations and just a lot of common background type things. So it was just such a really great experience. I think I really thrived with like writing in college because of him. So.
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot of folks that come to mind. Dave Murphy was a high school English teacher that had a big influence on me. But I want to talk about Liz Thompson, who was my seventh grade English teacher. Had recently moved, first year middle school. She took me under her wing and asked me what I thought about things, and then here's the important part. Listen to what I had to say. Profound. Nice. She's a great teacher. Now she's taking care of our firstborn, who's in her first year of middle school.
Oh, perfect.
Your favorite teacher. On the spot. So my favorite teacher was my father, who always said, never say more than you need to.
Love it. Anyone else on that side want to give a little something, something? All right, we'll move on to this side. Anyone on the end want to speak? All right, Senator Duckworth.
Well, there's a lot to pick from the elementary teachers that kind of loved on you as a little kid to the middle school teachers who made sure I got on the right track. But in high school, Susan Clark was one of my teachers, and went on to become a great friend in life as well. And she had a true penchant for identifying talents or abilities in kids and encouraging them to do things that would bring those talents out in them and help them master them and grow into something even better. So she was someone that was very, very impactful.
Thank you. Senator Sosinski.
Probably Connie Salverson, who told me it's okay if you just want to read what's not in the curriculum.
Senator McQuaid, if you need a minute, it's National Teachers Day, and so we are sort of reminiscing on our favorite teacher.
Oh, my goodness. Many, but my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Leek, who found books for me to read when I, like, just tore through the early readers. And then Miss Sagan, who was my choir teacher, my choir director when I was in high school.
Nice. Vanna, you want to say anything?
I'm like Sarah Duckworth, a number of them from elementary school were instrumental and cared about me. But today I'm thinking about my German language teacher, Mr. Fogarty. And we had a small class of students, like six or seven. And he was really wonderful because he treated us all like grown-ups and encouraged us to be really good at being who we were and then learning the German language. And the sad thing about Mr. Fogarty is after I graduated from high school, not too long after that, he got sick. He had some kind of cancer, and he passed away at a very young age. And it kind of breaks my heart because he was a great, great teacher and very affable, and students really cared about him, and we loved him.
And I'm thinking about my second grade teacher, Miss Ruland. So I grew up during, you know, those Vietnam War days, and her brother was in the war. And so I think that was sort of one of my sort of introductions to global cause and effect and, you know, the tragedy of war. But we wrote letters. We each had a pen pal, one of the soldiers, and she would send those letters back and forth to the soldiers. I have some of those letters still, but I think of how important it was for those soldiers to have connections with little second graders in the middle of rural Minnesota, and for us to have that kind of a relationship. I don't think we realized the profound time in history that it was. And I think it would be really great if we could go back and find those soldiers that we corresponded with and see where they are today. So as we see, teachers have a huge impact on our students. They are lasting impacts, whether they're the positive impacts, or sometimes we have not such positive interactions with teachers. And so I think it's important that we recognize the teachers that are out there today, in which is probably the most challenging time to be a teacher. And hopefully that we keep in mind that the work that we're doing here today and the work that we're doing in the legislature in this session and the next sessions are really focusing on those teachers that need the resources, need the positive affirmation, and are doing the hard work in our classrooms. So with that, I think we're going to begin discussion. We'll pick up where we left off yesterday. And we hadn't finished the spreadsheet. We did finish the spreadsheet. Great. So now we're going to move on to, I think we will start with the side-by-side, which is this document. Actually, I think we will wait. I think we will start with using this document, the summary. And the reason is I think we can move a little bit faster. There's a lot, and I hope you have all taken some time to go through, take notes, look at areas that we have in common, and you know the more depth language in the actual bill. And then as we are going along, we can, if you have questions, please don't hesitate to ask, because this is the time that we want to figure this out. So, yes, Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not gonna lie to you, I almost called you Ms. Kunesh. It did feel very, you're like, I hope you did your homework, we're gonna do this, we're gonna go side by side. When you're asking us to ask questions, are you wanting us to ask clarifying questions? Are you wanting us to ask like some of the big questions, like how are we reconciling these bills? Like how do you want us to set parameters around some of our questions?
I think that is a really good question. But I would say just ask the question that's on your mind. And if not, please make a note. And if you think that it's going to take us a lot more time to go into this, I'm sure we can, you know, talk offline. And if there are other people that have the same questions, then let us know. Okay. So with that, if our staff would like to begin, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tim Strom from House Research. We'll start with Article 1. Ms. Yelseth and I will walk through the article. There are two sets of documents, as you said, that are helpful. The side-by-side bill language, which the reviser prepared for us, is wonderful because it highlights the differences in the actual language. So it's often best to refer to that to see the particular differences. And then the bill summary, which House and Senate staff assembled, has three columns essentially on it. It's got the House provision on the left for House File 2497. And on the right, for the each of the two Senate bills, the provisions are there from Senate files, the equivalent of 2497, which is the first unofficial engrossment, and Senate file 1311, which is the policy bill. Then in the middle column is a column that's a comparison. And I think for purposes of keeping the conference committee moving, since both bodies are familiar with their own provisions, when the provision says same, essentially we'll just mention what the topic is. Sometimes we'll talk about differences that are slight, and those could be as small as grammatical differences or sometimes funding level differences. And then provisions where you'll see different or things like that are where the two bodies may have taken entirely different approaches to each of the issues being addressed. The way we'll work through this summary, I'll start on the House side, and whenever we come to a Senate provision that's different, Ms. Yelseth will pick up on the Senate side and continue again through until there's a House provision that's different on the other side. So we'll sort of alternate back and forth. Madam Chair, members, Article 1 is general education, and this article on the left again is the House provisions, and on the right side are the Senate provisions. The first provision, access to menstrual products, is the same in both bodies. The second section, Section 2 in the House, relates to the requirement for opiate antagonists at school sites. There's a requirement that each school district or charter school maintain a supply of opiate antagonists. The third section on the House bill is the same as the Senate section, having to do with the review and comment for construction projects. Essentially, because of the enhanced early voting periods, the notices need to be pushed back some. Section 4 is the same in both bills. This has to do with the board control of pupil transportation for non-public schools and allows contracting an agreement for the non-publics to provide that service. Section 5 is a House-only provision related to area learning center transportation. This provision is capped at $1 million per year and would reimburse school districts for a portion of their area learning center transportation costs. The fiscal note just recently came out at about twice the number, so the House funding would provide about 50% of the area learning center transportation.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Betsy Gelseth. I'm the nonpartisan analyst for the Education Committees in the Senate, so Tim Strom's counterpart. And moving on to page 4 of the side-by-side summary, we have from Senate File 2497, Section 2, it updates the online learning option definition of student to include those enrolled in a tribal contract or grant school. And then the next one is related to that provision. And it updates the online learning options average daily membership to include a student enrolled in a tribal contract or grant school.
Madam Chair, members, Section 6 on the House side codifies the Career and Technical Education Consortium. There's a base budget activity of $3 million for this program. The House extends the funding to $5 million and makes the program statewide. It's currently focused on rural school districts. Section 7 of the bill qualifies early child special education students for funded English learner services. Section 8 of the bill has to do with the basic English language learner revenue formula. Currently, that's $704. That amount of the basic formula would be increased from $704 to $1,000 per qualifying EL student. Then both bills later, you'll see, will deal with a percentage increase of funding for the English learner cross-subsidy aid. The general education basic formula allowance is in Section 9. The House is at 4% and 2%.
And the Senate is at 4%, yeah, 4% and then 5%. And then the main difference here is the House indexes the formula to inflation in fiscal year 26 and later, and the Senate does not.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Senator McQuaid.
You might have been about to say what I was going to ask.
Okay. So I think we should maybe take a minute and delve into this section, because I think this is the one that is probably the most divergent. And, you know, we have a lot of questions, and I'm sure I'm saying our Senate has a lot of questions on this, and I'm sure the House probably does as well. And so I'm wondering if somebody from MMB might come up to the desk, and maybe I can ask a few questions and we can start a conversation going here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. Just by way of suggestion and being on lots of conference committees, my suggestion would be that we would just note this, run through them all, and come back to the ones we note, because what I'm afraid of is we'll get down this conversation and we'll only get halfway through this document. So what if we just went through and put little notes by the ones that we're going to really delve deep into? That way we can narrow down the ones that we really want to talk about versus spending an hour or 45 minutes on something and preventing us from getting through the whole document. That's just a suggestion I would offer.
Thank you, Representative. But I think I'd like to take the time right now and do this. Okay. All right. So as you see, there is a difference between the House approach and the Senate. The House is wanting to increase the general education formula index it to inflation. I don't know that our Senate members or the Senate position has changed in that we don't really see that as the best approach going forward. So we have a few questions. We'd like to continue to set the formula allowance, and as you heard, ours is 4% in the first year and 5% in the second year. But some of my questions that I have, and maybe you can help us, would you please introduce yourself so we know who we're speaking to?
Yes, Jeff Schnobrick. I'm an executive budget officer at Minnesota Management and Budget. I work closely with the team at MDE. And my favorite teacher is my high school English teacher. She was really tough, but really good.
Excellent. Thank you. So I'm looking at the general appropriation to inflation seems like a potential forecast risk. I don't know that it really, or I'm not convinced that it gives the security that that the indexing might provide. And so I'm wondering that if you can perhaps respond to how indexing the basic formula to inflation will increase spending pressures. And I'm thinking like throughout our state government, creating a structural budget problem down the road. So if we were to index to inflation and education is appropriated those dollars according to the index right off the bat, that seems to me that it would leave right from the start, you know, a concern, and I'm hearing this from other chairs and other entities, that other committees or other agencies or other areas would right off the bat be at a deficit or might have a negative effect on the funding that they might receive. Do you know where I'm going here? Do you understand what I'm saying? And I'm wondering how would you see this across state government?
So I'd say a couple things. First, I appreciate the chance to talk about forecast risk. I think about forecast risk a lot, but I don't talk broadly about it. So I think the important thing is that dollars associated with forecast programs be tracked properly based on the best information that's available at the time. So the best information that's available to us right now is the February forecast. So any proposal to link the formula allowance to inflation should take into account the increased spending that would be projected based on that information from this forecast. So there's forecast risk in every forecast program, right, across state government. There are a number of things that can mitigate forecast risk. So two that I can think of in terms of this proposal are sort of timing and then some of the guardrails that are around the proposal in the House bill. So in terms of timing, inflation would first kick in for fiscal year 26, the fiscal year that starts in July of 2025, but the formula allowance would actually be known by January of 2025 based on a one-year look back. So while there is some risk right now that the numbers on the page, 1.97 and 2.18, 1.98 and 2.17, I'm sorry, there's some risk that those numbers might not be what actually happens. As we get closer to fiscal year 26, that risk is minimized and, in fact, is gone by the February forecast of the year prior to which inflation would start. The other thing that I would say is there are guardrails around the proposal. So in the event of a deflationary environment, the formula allowance wouldn't go below zero. And in the event of inflation greater than 3%, the formula allowance would be capped at 3%.
Thank you. Members, any follow-up questions? Go ahead, Chair.
Thank you, Senator. I am so sorry. Your last name again. We've met before. I'm sorry.
Snowbrick.
Thank you, Mr. Snowbrick. So you were talking about mitigating risk and guardrails, and it sounds like the way we have it drafted in the House bill, those guardrails are there. I've been digging into inflation in Minnesota over the last 50 years, and it seems like there are infrequent times where we actually hit that cap, but it seems like there seems to be a steady inflationary rate around 2 to 2.5% if you look at a longer block of time. Where would be the best place to look for that information, or do you kind of have that assumption when you're looking, when we're doing the forecast model in general, about where that inflation rate usually lands? Sorry, long question. You probably have a short answer.
I can try. Madam Chair, members, so looking back, using the methodology in the House bill, you would just look at the published CPI data and use the methodology that is in the bill. And I can't speak generally to what those numbers are off the top of my head, but they are what they are. In terms of going forward, we would use, for forecasts, we would use the data that's produced during the November and February forecasts that's produced by the state's macroeconomic consultant. And that goes forward anywhere from, I think, 10 years maybe. And so looking at those numbers going forward right now, so the numbers right now are 1.98 and 2.17. They hover just around 2, just above 2. Going forward through 2032.
One more follow-up.
Certainly.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh. So in essence, we'd be looking at making sure our districts had a 2 and a 2 every year as a base so they could keep up with inflation so that they have the money to do what they're already doing in the classroom. So I just wanted to check and see what that median look would look like. Thank you.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I, as a member of the Senate, this is not a bill that we heard, and so I'm trying to, like, do a mini hearing just to kind of get all of the information that I might want to know. My two questions are, could you just talk a little bit about, because we did do this, right? We indexed to inflation up until 2003, am I correct? No, we did not. We did not. We never did. For forecasting. Okay, thank you for that. So that was the second part of my question is, how does this interact with the forecast that includes inflation? And then the second part that I wanted to know is, nope, that was the first part. I forgot the second part already. You answer that part first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. So the laws 2023 Chapter 10, which was enacted, requires MMB to include inflation in the forecast. That is included as a separate line item to indicate the likely inflationary impact on expenditures. It does not change any particular program or appropriation. So what this committee does would change that appropriation and increase spending levels. Going forward, what MMB would do, if this formula were indexed to inflation, is we would take the chunk of money associated with that amount of inflation out of that sort of general inflation line, and we would move it into the E12 line on the fund balance. And then it would be associated right off the bat in the baseline with E12. As opposed to being a general sort of statewide line.
Follow up, Senator?
Probably, but you move on to other folks.
Okay. Senator Duckworth?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. And it's okay if you don't have these numbers in front of you, but I'm just curious, if 3% is the cap, could you give, you know, when we talk in percentages, sometimes we lose sight of the actual dollar amounts we're talking about. If we were to see an automatic 3% increase to this budget on an annual basis, can you give us a sense of what that actual dollar amount would be, what that increase would be?
So I wouldn't want to go off the top of my head on that. I will say on Ms. Beckel and Ms. Hofer's tracking, there are the numbers at the top and the associated figures with, you know, what 1.98 and 2.17% looks like after a 4 and 2. Of course, if you did it If in the first couple of years the increase was 4 and 5, then the amount associated with 3% or any additional percent would be different. So there's not one answer to that question. But I think we could probably get with fiscal staff and provide just sort of a general, here's about what 1% costs to give a sense of magnitude.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duckworth.
I guess I'll reserve my opinion and comments in regard to this topic, because that could lead to a more lengthy discussion, but I will have some of those if and when we get to that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Anyone else? Oh, Senator Gustafson.
Sorry, battling a microphone I'm not familiar with here. So, hi, thank you for answering the questions, and thank you, Madam Chair. One question I had was, does any other department do this, where they automatically link to inflation?
So there are a number of programs in the state budget, forecast programs, that have a sort of automatic increase built in. The one that comes to mind immediately is special education, because it's expenditure-based, so the natural growth in salaries and school district expenditures is actually picked up in that program. So when MMB currently calculates inflation, we back out special education because there's already an inflationary element built in. And then there are a number of programs at the Department of Human Services, managed care, long-term care. I don't know all of them off the top of my head, but there are those in DHS that have sort of automatic increases built in.
Senator Gustafson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what are they capped at, and what is typically what they – I guess, how does it look in compared to what's being proposed here?
Mr. Schnellberg.
That I cannot tell you. I know a fair amount about the E-12 budget, but HHS is not my area of expertise. We could get back to you on that.
Follow-up?
Oh, no, thank you.
Senator Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you run through that again about the special education? Why special education is unique? Why special education? What lessons can we learn for the rest of the education budget through special ed being indexed for inflation? And I'm just curious how that even started for special education. And I know you've kind of touched on it, but I'd like a little more input or, wisdom, if you would. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, I want to be careful not to imply that special education is tied to inflation. It's not directly tied to inflation, but there are sort of automatic increases built into our forecast because it's a reimbursement program. So special education reimburses about 60% of prior year costs, and prior year costs just sort of naturally increase over time as salaries and operating costs increase. So when you reimburse at the same percentage off of a growing base, there's sort of natural growth there.
Follow-up, Senator?
No, thank you.
Senator, oh my gosh, Chair Joachim.
Chair Kunish, I'm sorry, I apologize that I called you representative before.
I'm still proud to have been a former rep, no worries there.
I think 8:30 is not kind to me in the morning, so I just wanted to clarify and maybe have nonpartisan staff to say with the special education formula, it's a little different. I think we call it maintenance of effort because you can't go. Is that part of a federal law, or you can't go below what you spent the year before? Maybe someone can clarify that for my foggy brain this morning.
Mr. Strong.
Chair, Representative Joachim. The federal government does put a limited maintenance of effort requirement on school districts for special education funding. That it can be adjusted by some factors, but essentially requires the overall level of funding to be at least at the same level each year, and if it increases, it would need to stay at that new level.
Great. So I have a couple more questions that have kind of percolated. So, Mr. Schnellberg, is it possible that the legislature and this committee could build a formula increase percentage into law without linking it to inflation? So basically we could say every year it will increase automatically by a certain percent and not worrying about the inflation rate at that time.
I'm not aware of anything that would prohibit this body from doing that.
Great. And then another question is, If we were to index to inflation, the education formula, how would this affect future budgets? Let's say that there is a future downturn in the economic situation here in Minnesota. How would this affect it if we were in a deficit or inflation was out of control? Can you answer that for me, Mr. Schnellberg?
Yeah, so it's tough to predict exactly what will happen, but I think it would be similar to what policymakers would have to deal with across the state budget, right? So this indexing to inflation would increase future baselines of education spending against which, you know, MMB tracks our projected expenditures and projected revenues. In the event of a projected budget deficit, you would have the tools that you currently have available to deal with that. Use of budget reserves, reductions in baseline spending in education or elsewhere throughout the budget, or increases in revenue to bring resources in line with expenditures. Or there's other measures as well to deal with, you know, there have been school shifts in the past to address deficits.
So to follow up on that, can you explain the guardrails around accessing those budget reserves? Could we just easily dip into that?
I think it would follow the typical pattern, which is the legislature and governor, other policymakers, would consider whether or not that's an appropriate thing to do at that point in time.
So I am being told to ask about Section 16A.152 that directs a portion of surplus first to the budget reserve and then to several additional revenue priorities.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Sure. So if there is a budget surplus, Section 16A.152 directs a portion of surplus first to the budget reserve and then to additional revenue priorities. The budget reserve is healthy right now, and all additional revenue priorities are repaid. If the formula allowance is linked to inflation, are there any potential considerations about the budget reserve and these additional revenue priorities that the committee should take into account?
Madam Chair, members, so yes, 16A.152 lays out what must occur in the event of a positive general fund balance. It mentions making sure the cash flow account is topped off, the budget reserve is set at a specific amount, that any school shifts are paid back, and that any payments to the Minnesota 21st Century Fund be made according to statute. And then layered in there is another budget reserve calculation. I'm not aware of how this proposal would change that approach to budget reserves. Of course, the overall spending that changes as a result of indexing the formula to inflation will, of course, impact the bottom line. So there's always that sort of connection, but that's the same as every other area of the state budget.
Okay, and then just one more question, and if anybody else, you want to follow up on that, Senator McQueen? Okay, my last question is, if we were to index to inflation, and you mentioned that there were some guardrails that would be put in place, how could future legislators undo this? Would it be an easy task? Would it be difficult? I mean, what would the impact of that be?
Madam Chair, members, I will defer to you all on whether or not it might be easy or hard. So, you know, if we project at 2%, that inflation is going to be 2%, and then it comes in at 1.5%, that 1.5% increase would be built into the budget baseline. And if the desire were to increase it to 2% instead of that 1.5, that additional 0.5% would need to be allocated through the budget process. So in terms of how easy or hard that is, though, I will defer to you all.
Thank you. Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm going to try to repeat your timeline that you gave to me, and I might butcher it, and please correct me if I'm wrong. So in January of 2025, we'll kind of do a look ahead, but by July 2025, we'll know kind of what the inflation will be, and then in fiscal 2026 is when it begins to be indexed to inflation. How close am I?
Madam Chair, Senator, let me just lay out the whole process again. So as currently proposed in the two bills, the formula allowance would be set as a set number in statute in FY24 and FY25, and then for FY26, it would be set based on a calculation that's laid out in statute. So for FY26, which is July 1st, 2025 to June 30th, 2026, the formula allowance would be set in January of 2025 by doing a one-year look back. So it would actually be the Commissioner of Education would look at the CPI in October, November, and December of 2023 versus October, November, and December of 2024. And then a couple weeks after that, in January of 2025, the Commissioner would publish what the formula allowance will be, and then that would get built into the February forecast. So it would be known by January 2025, about 5 or 6 months prior to the start of the fiscal year.
And follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That was super helpful. So if we had done that, let's say we'd passed this in 2020, at the end of the legislative session in 2020, or no, let's say we did it in 2022, and so they would have done the look back in 2021, what would inflation have been in real time, and what would we have set that, and I'm sorry, I'm asking you to do math in real time, what would we have set the indexing to inflation number at?
Madam Chair, Senator, we did do that exercise to look back at what would have happened. In both 2022 and 2023, it would be at that 3% cap.
Okay.
So the actual numbers would have been high sixes and low sevens for those 2 years, but it would have hit that 3% cap.
Follow up, Ms. Cisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, and feel free to not answer this question right now, but I think my biggest question is, these are obviously two different philosophies of each chamber. And my question is, one, maybe it would be helpful to hear both chairs kind of explain their philosophies behind this, because I think that's useful. And then if we can, how are we going to reconcile these two different philosophies?
That's an excellent question. That's why we're working on this. Senator Duckworth.
So just a brief follow-up, Madam Chair, and I appreciate it. So if I'm understanding what's being proposed correctly, we're saying we want to index to inflation, but really, honestly, what we're saying is we just want to guarantee at least a 3% increase year over year if inflation is higher than that. If it's less than 3%, we'll match whatever inflation is. If it's over 3%, we'll cap it at 3. Is that kind of what we're saying? We will never go below zero. So we'll index to inflation, and we'll take the positive aspects of it. We'll never take the negative aspects of it, but we're never going to go above 3% unless we take action to purposely do so as a legislature. Is that what I'm understanding?
Mr. Schnellberg.
Madam Chair, Senator, exactly.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Follow up? Representative Hill.
Well, thank you, Chair Kunish. You know, I think it's important to note, over the last 2003 is the year that's pointed to historically, that really changed the way we engaged in funding our schools here in Minnesota. And, you know, let me get a little closer. I think it's important to note that in every budgeting discussion that I have witnessed, that I've taken part in, at both a local level, at the school board level, or at the state level, we continue to talk about 2 years in the early 2000s, where we funded our schools with a 0% increase. And in every one of those discussions, it comes up at least once that had we not done that, we would be in a vastly different place. And so we can talk about risk factors associated with this philosophy, but I think it's also important to point out and talk about the reward factors, that had we increased our funding by even 2% in those years, due to inflation, our students would be experiencing a much different and brighter experience in our schools. And the amount of services that we were able to provide would be vastly different. And so this is a philosophical discussion that I know will continue on, but it's not something that came out of the ether. There's a reason why we want to talk about indexing this to inflation, and making sure that our schools are able to meet the needs that, that every one of their students bring in every day.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that part of our discussion, we talked about what indexing to inflation will mean for what I think the important distinction is what we call base. So when there's been inflation, we account for that, and we say to keep our schools at the base level where they are right now, we reflect what that inflationary increase up to 3%. So we would be coming in at this moment in time and not saying, you know, what our last budget was that we passed, but we would say base reflects already 3%, and then we would know that inflation was even higher than that. It was 6%. And so then we would know that we needed to increase, if we really wanted to keep our schools at the same level, it would have been that already 3% increase, which we call base now, rather than an increase, you know, more money for schools. It's like, nope, we're just keeping them at that base level that reflects a 3%. And then we would be talking about an additional 3% to keep up with inflation. So I think when we're talking about indexing to inflation, what we're really saying is that we come in every budget cycle with a new definition of what base is, and that it shows this minimal increase of indexing to inflation every time. So we don't always talk about these big increases, because a lot of that increase just means keeping up with inflation. And if we don't do that, then essentially we're giving schools cuts in funding. And so I think we just kind of change where we start the conversation rather than where we finish the conversation, because I think we can still be talking about increases in funding even when we've accounted for those inflationary increases already.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Gustafson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted a follow-up question to what Representative Pryor was saying. So you're talking about a base of 3%, but wouldn't it actually be at 2 and then it capped at 3? Isn't that what it would be at? Or
this is where the finance chair can speak better, if the finance chair is willing to continue this part of the discussion.
And I could totally be wrong, too. I'm just wanting to make sure I understand. Yeah.
Chair Yoakim.
Yeah. Thank you. And to go back to Representative McQuaid's question as well, why we're thinking of it this way is, one, the stability for the schools in their budget. As you heard Mr. Schnellbrick say, they would know by January of 2025, when they're setting their budgets in April and having to send out those pink slips, what they actually would be guaranteed to have instead of making a guess. So that's part of the stability that is what we like. While I would love to set an automatic percentage in statute going forward, I don't know if that's as fiscally responsible as tying it to something like inflation with the guardrails and the caps. And why inflation, when you look at inflation, we know we're all paying it in our pocketbooks, so are our schools. So unless we're helping them keep up with that inflation, if we hit that zero and zero, which we have over the years, it's a cut. And if there's an economic downturn, but they're sticking with inflation, then we're actually talking about what reality is and saying, okay, well, this would be a cut to our schools, because at least they're getting inflation, and then if we tried to change it, we would be balancing. We don't want to be balancing the back of our budget on our kids. I remember Representative Markport that always used to call it eating your seed corn. Like, they are our future, and having them educated properly, I hate to sit and think like, well, but what are we going to do if there's an economic downturn? We have the guardrails in place. It's set to inflation. If there's an economic downturn, at least we're not eating our seed corn.
Follow-up, Senator?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand, and I hear all that. I guess my question is that I heard you sort of explain it differently as a base of 3%.
No.
Okay. So maybe if I ask my second question, maybe that's a little bit more clarifying. If we're doing 4 and 2 and linking it to inflation, then we always know there's going to be at least a 2%. When I say base, it seems like that's the wrong word you want me to say. So, but that's like a 2% where you want but linked to inflation, meaning that it can only be capped at 3, though. And then if we are in some sort of an economic downturn, it would take the legislature to come in and add an additional percentage on top of the 3% max out place, mm-hmm, in order to be able to take care of our schools.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pryor.
I like being a representative too. I appreciate that. Right. And so what got me nervous was, I mean, we're not saying that every year, because we're indexed to inflation, there's going to be a 3% increase, because inflation is not always that high. And some years there have been virtually no inflation. And so then we wouldn't be coming in understanding that the base of holding schools where they are right now. But yes, the cap is in this, in the House proposal, is 3% for inflation. And exactly as you just said, we know that these last couple of years inflation has been higher than 3%. And so when we come in to do the budget, we understand that it's like, okay, 3% is only getting us partway there. But at least when we keep talking about the timing of things. I mean, I know that there's a lot of school districts that saw an increase of only 1% when they made their budgets. But this would have changed that dynamic, is they would have said, hey, we're at least going to get a 3% increase because the legislature has made that commitment to keep up at least to that point in keeping up with inflation. And I'm starting to not articulate very clearly because we blah, 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 what could have happened and things like that. But I hope that we're connecting and understanding, and that I'm expressing it at least as closely so I'm not confusing people and making it worse. And again, it's the finance chair. Well, that was policy.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, inflation is not my wheelhouse. I am, by the way, a current history teacher, so, you know, we could, I could prepare, on, I guess, a report on the history of inflation. But I just know that, you know, and it fluctuates. You're correct. You're right. It was at 8%, I believe, last year. I think it's dipped now down to around 5%. So, I mean, that's good news. But if we know that we're always capped at 3, I wonder if that's still, it still is an amount of uncertainty for schools, even though, and this isn't, you know, to say that I don't, that I'm adamantly against it, just to say that I'm not sure it fully solves the problem that we're trying to solve. You know, which is why I appreciate Chair Kunish's 5% increase in the following year. But yeah, thank you for answering my questions.
And Chair Yoakim, you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, I just clarify a little further. That's why I asked what the median inflationary increase had been over the last 20 years. And when it hovers around 2%, it's just that certainty that districts will get money for what they're already doing. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to us to have the same conversations we're having every year up here already. What more do they need beyond that? And that's why it's so important for them to at least keep up with inflation. So then we have a level set that we all know, and then we can have the real discussions. And having that set in January helps give those districts stability before they're going into their budget discussions too, instead of waiting until we're done, possibly by July 1st, and knowing that they have that stability just to actually have the money to keep up with what they're already having to do. And then we can have those real discussions going forward.
And if I can just ask you, Chair Yoakim, so we get that number in January, but it really wouldn't be until February, correct? That it's the end of January that we get those numbers. Is that correct, Mr. Schnobrick? And so it would be February before we could set either that inflation amount or a formula amount.
Madam Chair, members, I think the data would be available around the middle of January, so anyone could go to the BLS website and calculate it. I think the commissioner would probably do a calculation and an announcement. I don't want to speak for what the commissioner would do, but I imagine it would be something like that. So it would be known by mid-January, and then the sort of fuller financial picture would be available with the February forecast at the end of February.
And Mr. Schnobrick, so it's the commissioner who is going to be setting that inflationary rate. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members, the commissioner would be tasked with looking at the BLS data and doing the calculation. So the BLS data would determine the amount, but the commissioner is tasked with telling everyone what that amount is based on the calculation.
Okay, so it would not be the legislature that decides on the inflationary increase. It would be the commissioner. So is there anything that would be stopping us from now, you know, the way that we do it now, we're debating on what the percent or how we should fund education, whether it's a formula or this indexing to inflation. And here we are in the middle of May or the beginning of May. Is there anything that stops us from setting either a formula percentage or so if we did the formula route, we could set that formula in February and not wait until now to do that, so that the schools had that security or that stability that they're looking for. So if the commissioner is going to set the inflationary rate, say mid-February, when we're indexing, is there anything that's stopping us from setting that formula percentage mid-February in statute? Mr. Schnellberg.
Madam Chair, I think technically and from an implementation standpoint, no. Though I know the February, so the November forecast sort of sets the table for what the projected expenditures and resources might be. The February forecast gives us another bite at the apple to refine that and get more accurate. So setting anything before the February forecast, while it can be done, that marker sort of gives the fuller financial picture.
Yeah, and just to follow up, I had something whispered to me, but that was in my head too. So why would we set the inflationary rate before the February forecast?
Madam Chair, it would be set on a, it would be based on a set of data that would then be incorporated into the February forecast.
Okay.
As the new base.
Okay, thank you. Just one second. Did you have a comment, Senator? Oh my gosh, Representative Joachim.
Yeah, Senator Kunesh, I know you're saying we could set the formula ourselves as a legislature, but we still have to go through the entire process, and we don't pass a bill until the end of May or middle of May, and you never know what that's going to look like. So that's why having it set and tied to inflation gives that, you know, minimal amount to give that sense of security.
And Senator McQuaid, is it to this question or this topic, or is it another question? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm really versed on is the argument to doing it, to indexing to inflation, right? Because when we have a conversation at the legislature about increasing on the formula 1%, but inflation's been 2.5%, we're actually reducing school budgets, and we keep talking about it like we're increasing it, and we're not. And I was here, we were here during that time period, and it was really frustrating. So I'm fully versed in that argument. I think it would be really helpful for me, and I don't want to speak any for my committee members, to just hear both chairs kind of go through their philosophies, because I hear that you're really committed to kind of how we've done it in our bill. Chair Joachim, I hear that you're committed to how you've done it in your bill. And it would be helpful if both of you kind of talked through your philosophies and just kind of your arguments for it. It doesn't have to be like a debate, but I think it would just be helpful to hear those articulated out loud as for us as a committee as we go forward.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Clarity had a question or a comment.
Thank you. I will listen to the chairs and what they're going to say. I guess what we're focusing on is stability, and I was just wondering, is there a current model that's showing success with these that we're basing it on looking forward? So I'm just going to wait and hear your responses to that. So I'm just wondering, what are you basing your models on? I know that you're focusing on stability, but what's the key factor? Where did you get the specific model for that you're advocating for? So going back to what Senator McQuaid was saying, I'm going to listen to the chairs.
Sure. Do you want to do that?
I can do that now. Thank you, Senator. I think I feel like I've already kind of laid out where our philosophy is, and that's to make sure our districts have the stability when they go into going to setting their budgets, so they're not waiting for us until the end of session. I believe that tying it to inflation with the guardrails around it, especially the cap, also is fiscally prudent. And the fact that we would be talking about real numbers then, instead of saying, oh, look, we're giving you a 1% increase, but inflation was 4%. Or so that way, when we go into these discussions, we have the real numbers that our districts are having to look at as well. And it basically is by just tying it to inflation with our guardrails, which makes it fiscally prudent. I'd love to tie it totally to inflation so it really gets to the heart of, like, they're getting the funding they need to do what they're already doing. But we do have to be fiscally prudent, so I think those guardrails are really important. But no, we are basically making sure the districts have the money that they've already they have the money that they need to already do the services that they have for the kids when it comes to just meeting the basic needs, keeping the lights on, keeping their teachers there, and then we can start talking about moving forward once we stabilize that. What more do we need to see better test scores? What more do we need to make sure our kids are ready to fit into the world economy? I was a baby advocate, not too baby, but in 2003, that fateful year a lot of us talk about when we had a lot of the budget cuts. And I remember we were talking about two things. I was on the Hopkins LAC, and we were talking about the SPED cross subsidy. At the time, was only about 2% of districts' budget. Now they're 6 to 8, and we're still talking about it. And we were also talking about indexing the formula to inflation. Now, I like the IPD better than the CPI, because CPI is more of a basket of goods, where the implicit price deflator is more structured around services provided. And when districts' budgets are 85% of people, that's a service provide. But that CPI would be good enough, because I think it is a little bit more stable. But back then, from my understanding, and now I'm not great at back number napkin math, that's why I married a math teacher instead. But currently, that base ADM per pupil that we have, that's $6,863. If we would have indexed to that to inflation 20 years ago, we'd be over 10,000. And then we're really cooking with gas, because I still like my gas stove. But we have, you know, we really have been underfunding our schools for the last 20 years. I honestly, truly believe that. And I know a lot of you have worked in schools and have been in schools, and I think you see that too. So just providing this ability to give this little stability to our districts, and then we can have those real conversations about what more we need to do. And then we can also have those real conversations about, and I know I've talked to many of you, you know, mandate, okay, mandate's a word. Everything we do here is a mandate. Every law is a mandate, right? But whether or not you consider it unfunded or we consider it accountability is a discussion we can finally have too and be honest about it. So that's my philosophy down the rabbit holes. Thank you.
And I'll just kind of go back on, you know, I also was a strong like supporter of indexing to inflation for a long, long time, recognizing that our schools need that stability. But it just, I had an aha moment when we were putting our budget together and we were looking at what we had this year, and we did a scenario where we indexed to inflation and then we did a scenario where we didn't. In this day and time right now, if we indexed to inflation right now, I would not be able to create the kind of bill that we created, the robust bill that we created, that covers so much from early childhood through adult ed and community ed, because we would be limited to that inflation. And so, you know, that was sort of my aha moment. And, you know, I'm just not sure that it really does give us that stability, because, you know, as we've heard here, if inflation is 0%, or 1.5%, that does not give those schools the security or the stability that they want. There's still going to be a lot of fluctuation. We can say up to 3%, but that doesn't mean that they would, you know, that we would be able to do that full 3%. So there's still a lot of questions. There's still a lot of stability. And I, for one, you know, I was a teacher for 25 years. I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of what the legislature mandates or funds or doesn't fund at a really base level. So I want to make sure that our schools and our districts have those dollars that they have, that they need to really get into, get down to those classrooms, to those teachers, to those students. But I don't know that this is the very, very best way to do it. And I'm also thinking, again, if education gets that chunk off the top every time, I really do wonder about how it is going to affect the rest of our state government. Sometimes, you know, there are other areas, HHS, agriculture, transportation, infrastructure, and it's so important that we are funding or trying to get as close to fully funding our schools as possible, but are we also at the same time having adverse effect across the entire state government? So I'm taking kind of a more holistic approach to this, and while I'm sure we will come to an agreement at one point, I think that this discussion has really been important. I think it helps us to bring what was the elephant in the room to the center, and hopefully all of us have heard these different perspectives, this different idea of how we can best fund our educational system. And I'm confident that we will, at the end of the day, come to an agreement that is going to be in the best interest of our schools. So are there any other questions or comments? And then I think we better move along. Representative Yoakim.
Thank you, Senator Kunish. I just want to thank you for letting us have this conversation. I think you're right. I think it was very important to bring this out and to have questions answered. And thank you for having your expertise at the table. And I would just say I'm glad we have a time frame to hit this bill in, and we can't really talk a lot about anything else until we get this settled. So thank you for letting us have the conversation.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you, Mr. Schnellbrook. All right. Let's move on. I believe we are at Section 10.
Madam Chair, members, one point for Senator Duckworth before we move on. In terms of the percentage increase, we use a rule of thumb on the House side of about $70 million for each 1% increase in the formula allowance. And then remember, that'd be cumulative. So if you wanted a back-of-the-envelope style calculation, a 1% increase would be $70 million the first year. If it went up another 1% in the second year, it'd be another $140 million in the second year. So if you use that $70 million as a 1% for a rule of thumb, that'll give you the overall numbers that you were asking about.
I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, if I may, while we're on that topic, could you just do me a favor and give us a quick frame of reference as to what the total budget is, or what the total spending is on a two-year cycle for education?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for education, the total spending for a two-year budget for fiscal year, well, that's the change spreadsheet. Basically, the total spending for biennium for education is roughly $21 billion for 2 years. Yeah.
Thank you. $21 billion. And does education still hold the number one slot in terms of the largest state, the largest area that the state has in terms of budgeting, or have we been surpassed by Health and Human Services yet? Just curious.
Response.
It's okay if you don't know. I was going to ask that earlier, but we ran out of time on the last topic. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Duckworth, I believe it sort of goes back and forth with HHS, but I think at this time it's still roughly 39% of the state budget. So it is the largest of general fund spending, I should clarify. So when it comes to federal funds that the state receives, I believe that the Health and Human Services area does garner a larger portion of the federal funds that the state receives.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And where are we?
Madam Chair, members, Section 10 on the bottom of page 5 is a provision on the House side only. This would provide extended time revenue for summer school programs for children who are attending a care and treatment facility, whether that's a day treatment program or a residential program. Under current law, there's just one facility or two facilities essentially that are included. This would expand it to any children's residential or day treatment facility. Section 11 is in the bill just as an adjustment mechanism. The House and Senate work under similar zero levy target provisions, and if there are other levies being approved, a levy has to be reduced in a different area. The lever that both the House and Senate use for lowering the market value levy is the local optional revenue amount. That's a number that staff will just back into for you once you've agreed upon your other levy changes in the bill. The next three, four sections have to do with compensatory revenue. As the Senate is aware, there were some big changes this past year with the direct match on medical assistance, and then the bill that passed earlier this session for free meals for all included provisions that have some concern about the ongoing levels of compensatory revenue. The provision that passed that was added on the Senate side covers fiscal year 25, and the House picks up recommendations from the governor in these four sections to essentially modify the compensatory revenue formula going forward so that there would not be a reduction in compensatory due to change in counts or change in participation in the counts for fiscals 26 and forward. The next section then, scrolling down to section 16, is the English learner basic skills revenue. That's the same in both bills. Section 17 has to do with the operating capital revenue. The increase is the same in both bills of $2 per pupil, but the House also includes, in addition to the menstrual products, the opiate antagonists into the list of what that $2 per pupil can be spent on. Section 18, just as I mentioned with the local optional revenue, is the lever that the legislature uses to adjust the net tax capacity levy changes. So again, House and Senate staff at the end of the process will back into the equalizing factor that's necessary to make sure there's zero overall levy increase in this year's bill. Section 19 of the House is the uses of total operating capital. The House and Senate have the same language regarding menstrual products, but the House also adds the opiate antagonists as an allowable use of operating capital revenue. Section 20 of the House bill on page 8 of the summary is the pupil transportation sparsity adjustment. Current law has the adjustment at 18.2%, and the House raises that to 40%. Section 21 has to do with the class size reporting. The House and Senate have slightly different language. Ms. Yelseth may want to speak to the Senate language. This is a good place for members to look at these two sections in the side-by-side language when you have a moment to see the detailed differences. But essentially, it has to do with the class size reporting that each school district would do. And Ms. Yelseth, I don't know if you'd like to add.
Thank you,
Ms. Hilsa.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yeah, Mr. Schramm said it great. It's just reporting for class size ratios and for on the Senate side, it's just by each grade. And then moving on to Section 15 of the House File 2497, we have general education disparity aid, which is not included in the House bill, and this creates a new general education disparity aid revenue stream for districts. And it's based on taking a calculation times the greater of zero, or the difference between the amount of general education revenue per adjusted pupil unit for each district, and then comparing that to the district below, the district immediately below the 20th percentile.
Madam Chair, members, Section 22 has to do with the uses of compensatory revenue. The House bill proposes to restructure and narrow those uses a bit. And again, the language in the bill will show the differences between the current uses and the proposed uses of the that are in the House bill. Section 23 has to do with the percentage of compensatory revenue that must remain at each school site. Current law is at 50%. The House proposes to change that to 60% and the Senate to 80%. Section 24 on the bottom of page 9 is the annual expenditure report that accompanies compensatory revenue. There were recommendations in the auditor's report a couple of years ago on how that report could be more helpful. The House and Senate have slightly different language for determining what's reported in that regard. Section on the top of page 10, section 25 of the House and 17 of the Senate have to do with referendum renewal by school board. The Senate allows one renewal, so essentially a referendum could run for 20 years. The House language says the same thing, but I think we may have some confusion on what the House intended on that. Section 26 has to do with unemployment insurance. There are a number of provisions related to unemployment insurance in this bill. And I don't know if there's going to be a discussion at a different time of that, but essentially, under current law, certain hourly workers are excluded for unemployment insurance over the summer term. Both the House and Senate bill have a similar intent, have slightly different language to do this, but would essentially include those hourly workers in the unemployment insurance system for the summer term if they were not offered suitable employment. I don't know if the Senate, Madam Chair, would like to say more about their particular provision on unemployment insurance.
Would you please, Ms. Gilstep?
Madam Chair, members, I would just add for the House Section 26, matching up with the Senate Section 18, that's just ensuring that levies don't increase for the unemployment insurance for hourly workers. And on the next page, the main difference between the House and Senate provision is the Senate limits it to just school districts, charter schools, the Minnesota State Academies, and Purpich Center, where the House is all K through 12 entities, so non-public.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the next two sections, 27 and 28, have to do with school trust lands, the director's duties, and some of the authority the director has. Those provisions are in the same in both bills.
Moving on to page 11 of the summary, the Senate includes section 27, and it's on page R22 of the bill, and it just increases the number of board members on the Minnesota School High School League from 20 to 22 members. And then the next section, Mr. Trum and I reviewed, related to providing unemployment insurance benefits to hourly employees during the summer term. And to add on that, the House also includes higher education staff, and the Senate does not. And then moving on to page 12 is the same provision. It modifies the process for when a K through 12 education credit program certification is denied, and also corrects some statutory citations. The next section, 21, the Senate only includes, and it updates the effective date for laws 2021, and this relates to removing the $2 million English learner aid in fiscal year 24 and 25. And as a side note, this should actually be included right before the appropriation section. So the summary is just in the wrong place, just on a technical note. The next section related to reporting requires the Department of Education and the Department of Employment and Economic Development to report to the legislature related to the unemployment insurance benefits, how many hourly employees are receiving those benefits during the summer term. And then the House and Senate have similar language on that, or the similar intent, just a little bit differences in language. The next section, section 32, is the same, and this provides a fund transfer for the Burnsville Egan Savage School District. And then Mr. Strom will take it away for section 33 on page 13.
Madam Chair, members, section 33 is the last of the House provisions related to compensatory revenue. There's some concern that a number of applications, which are often referred to as the paper forms, they may be filled out electronically, but that those will decline as more school districts offer free meals for all. And so there's a report that's required from the commissioner about whether the paper forms could be eliminated entirely, and if so, what other consequences that would have for other data collection methods for formulas and other purposes.
And then section 29 is a Senate provision only. It clarifies when report mandates expire for the Department of Education. Section 20, again, is Senate only, and that's relating to that removing the $2 million English learner aid for fiscal year 24 and 25, which was implemented in 2021 laws. Page 14 of the summary. Oh, Mr. Strong. Oh, it's just the appropriations. And I would just add the repealer section 36, repeals laws. What the Senate does is we repeal the additional general education aid for compensatory that passed with the universal meal bill, and then we have reappropriated that amount into our general education appropriation section. And I'm not sure if Mr. Strom has anything else to add on the House side.
And Madam Chair, one tiny House provision on the top of page 14, the House carries a provision in this bill that any appropriation that's enacted this year should be enacted only once. There are a number of bills that are moving separately, including the early childhood bill, and this just ensures that essentially by mistake that we don't provide double funding if a provision gets in both bills. And Madam Chair, that's it for Article 1.
Excellent. All right. I think we are going to continue. Oh, a question here. Representative Kreshak.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back to the unemployment piece, the difference between the House and the Senate is the pool of workers. The Senate has reduced that, if I understand that correctly, based off of the House. I'm just curious why the differences of who's affected.
So, Representative Kreshak, we limited it to our the public schools, and we did not include higher ed.
And why?
Madam Chair, if I may, as the higher ed lead in the Senate.
Senator Duckworth.
The higher ed piece was included in the Senate higher ed bill.
Any other questions? Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Senator Kunish. Wondering, I had been under the impression that federally we couldn't carve out a set of workers like non-public schools, but maybe if any of the staff could clarify for that for me. That might have to be a UI question, deed question.
Senator Gustafson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that was a provision that Dee did bring forward just a day or so before ours that was on the floor. And so it was, I think, under the intent that it would be cleaned up in conference. So.
And that is the answer. Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Kreshak's question, I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know that there was a UI provision that was included in a Senate labor bill that was not included in the education bill, and is that the same one that's included in the House education bill, or are they different? Yeah, so I think we just have a difference of maybe where they're showing up in the Senate and in the House, which respective bills, and how that all will get ironed out, we'll see, but that's also maybe one reason why we're seeing it in different spots.
Yes. Any other questions on anything in the first article?
Just a couple brief ones, Madam Chair. Thank you. And it's okay if some of this is offline follow-up. But I did ask some questions regarding on page 9, section 23 in the House, section 16 in the Senate, why some modifications or tweaks to the threshold for compensatory revenue were being considered or proposed, and what sort of impact that will have on school districts. And then as we move to page 10, the renewal by a school board in terms of the operating referendum, I know there are some big pieces that we have to resolve in this bill, but I think this is going to be a big one too, as to whether or not the Senate's version, which allows for that one-time renewal versus the House's version, which would allow for an unlimited number of renewals. Being a former school board member, I can see the appeal of that piece, but I can also understand maybe having some parameters around it. So I think that will be important for us to resolve as well. And then figuring out the UI piece, if it's going to happen, what bill it's going to exist in, because that's obviously going to impact the targets of respective committees. So that's all I've got for this section. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Duckworth. And we are continuing to have those conversations around unemployment insurance. It is a complex issue, and there are a lot of things that we need to consider and consequential action. So those conversations are continuing, and we will continue to really sort them out in the best way. Representative Kreshak.
Thank you. And just for clarity, so when you say we, are those conversations outside a conference committee, or are those conversations that are going to be handled in the conference committee? I mean, is there a backroom deal? Is that what you're saying is going on?
There are discussions that are sorting out as we continue to like address and try to sort out, problem solve some of the bumps in the road. But at some point when we feel like it's at a discussable point, then I'd like to bring it into the, if we have time, I'd like to bring it into this committee.
So, Matt, follow up. So what I'm hearing, I've been through lots of conference meetings, so there are conversations going on. We're going to do lots of things in here. And then are we just going to get the directive to close the conference committee and then go based on conversations that may or may not have happened here?
To be decided. We aren't just sure how this is going to play out, so we will keep you posted as best we can.
Okay.
Any questions? All right, let's move on to Article 2. And I do plan to recess at about 10:30. We have session at 11. So if there's anything in between, let's give ourselves a little bit of time for questions.
Madam Chair and members, we're now on Article 2, which is on starts on page 15 in the side-by-side summary language. And it's in a separate packet, I think, of stuff on bill language. And I think we'll follow the same pattern that Mr. Strom and Ms. Jelsis did. So the first section is the same in both bodies, and that's removing the need for a teacher competency exam as a relicensure requirement under compulsory ed.
And Madam Chair and members.
Ms. Pera.
Section 2 on the House side applies to the e-learning days section, and it requires a district or charter school to pay all employees full wages and benefits for all scheduled work hours during an e-learning period, and to allow employees to work from home to the extent practicable. Section 3 is the same for both the House and Senate. It modifies the definition of a required standard, and it requires districts to adopt state art standards. Section 4 is similar, but one big difference is the social studies standards. The House requires social studies standards to include ethnic studies. Other changes, including in this section, and relate to math and science and arts. Section 5 is the same for both bodies. It relates to the Department of Education's rulemaking authority. Section 6 is the same for both and relates to the career and technical education standards, which are elective standards. Section 7 is graduation requirements, and these are slightly different, so I'll let the Senate speak to that provision. But in the House modifies the math, science, and social studies credit requirements, requiring students to complete a course for credit in civics in grade 11 or 12 and complete enough credits to satisfy physical education standards. Also to complete a half credit in personal finance, and requires a district to offer a course for credit in civics to students in grades 11 or 12.
And Madam Chair, members, on the Senate side, the big differences are the civics requirement for graduation requiring a course in government and citizenship in either grade 11 or 12, or a rigorous course in government and citizenship. And then in personal finance, there's a requirement of a one course credit during the senior year of high school, and it can be whether it's in person or a hybrid or online. Then section 8 of the House file and section 9 of the or section 7 of the Senate file are similar, and it relates to credit equivalencies in the Senate file. It just is limited to ag and food and natural resources programs for economics credit.
Madam Chair, members, the House for that section adds ethnic studies language, allowing a student to use an ethnic studies credit to fulfill
social studies, language arts, science, arts, or an elective credit if it meets applicable standards. The next section is men's the world's best workforce, and it's the same, well, it's similar, I should say. The same terms are defined by each body, though some of the definitions are different. I think in particular, anti-racist and culturally sustaining, I believe, are different. The next section also continues with the world's best workforce requirements. And those are different. The House amends the world's best workforce plan requirements and requires plans to include a process to assess ethnic studies curriculum needs, access to ethnic studies curriculum using culturally responsive methodologies, and to integrate curriculum that's rigorous, accurate, anti-racist, and culturally sustaining, and some other elements.
And the Senate file has some just different elements of the strategic plan that are not that I think are the same as the ones in the House file.
Madam Chair.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do want to make this comment publicly because this might not happen this year, but we need to rename World's Best Workforce. We can't keep talking about our kids that are supposed to be like whole people as a workforce. So we just need to rename that at some point. It doesn't have to be this year, but I just need to state that for the record.
Thank you, Senator. You may continue.
Then, Madam Chair, members, we're on page 19, the House file section 11 and Senate file section 4, and it's again another world's best workforce provision that about the district advisory committee, and it's same in both bodies as well as the next section related to gifted and talented students programs services, and then we get to section 13 of the House file and section 1 of the Senate file, which are the definitions for ethnic studies, and they are very similar. The Senate made some edits to it, but I don't think they have a difference of intent.
And Madam Chair, the next section on the House side is section 14. The House carries an ethnic studies provision that uses the definition from previous sections and adds requirements relating to courses that districts have to offer, rulemaking for the department relating to ethnic studies standards, requiring a district to conduct an ethnic studies needs assessment and annually evaluate the implementation of ethnic studies instruction, requires the department to hire dedicated ethnic studies staff to fulfill specific duties. And it requires the department to support districts and charter schools in using a model curriculum identified by a working group that's described in a later section and materials developed by members of the community that are the subject of the course. The next section is a House-only section. It's on Holocaust and genocide education. It requires a school district to offer Holocaust and genocide education as part of the social studies curriculum for middle and high school. Specific elements must be included in that. The district has to provide Holocaust and genocide education by the 24-25 school year in accordance with rules on social studies standards and benchmarks. The next section, section 16 on the House side, section 8 on the Senate side, it's the same for both bodies relating to statewide testing. The next section is also the same for both, relating section 17 on the House, 9 for the Senate, relating to statewide and local assessments and results. It strikes several definitions relating to above grade and below grade test items. Section 18 on the House and section 10 on the Senate are also the same, relating to limits on local testing and amending a date. Section 19 for the House and section 11 for the Senate are the same as well, relating to how growth is measured on state assessments. Section 20 for the House and 12 for the Senate is also the same, relating to state growth targets for state assessments. Section 21 for the House and 7 for the Senate is the state model policy, the student bullying policy. And those requirements are the same for both bodies. The next section, Section 22, these are similar. It's it defines malicious and sadistic conduct and prohibits it. And I'll let Ms. Lewis speak to the differences with those.
Madam Chair, members, the difference is punctuation. The House has commas and the Senate has semicolons.
Madam Chair.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to note this for our nonpartisan staff. If we're looking at how we're defining sexual orientation as defined in 363A, which is our Human Rights Act, there's going to be a change likely in the definitions in 363A to add gender identity, and so we might want to add that in here so that we're accurately citing, referencing the chapter that we're referencing.
Thank you. You may continue.
Madam Chair, members, then the next section, it gets us to page 24 on the side-by-side summary. It's the multi-tiered system of supports and collaborative Minnesota partnerships to advance student access, so MTSS and Compass, and they are the same in both bills. Then the Senate file is section 2, and it's a there's actually a similar provision in the House file, and it's done a different way, but this allows the Department of Education to use the fee that they collect for administrating different things in the online learning program. Section 4 is a Senate-only provision, and it is allowing high school credit for students that work in for healthcare providers. And then Section 5 on the Senate side, another Senate-only provision, and it's a requirement to put, if possible, suicide prevention information on student identification cards. Then on the next section, there's a similar between the House and Senate, and this is where we begin the discussion on discipline, and it's for the definition of non-exclusionary discipline policies and practices. Then the next section, 25 on the House file and section 2 on the Senate file, are the same, and that's the section that deals with pupil withdrawal agreements. The next section, 26 of the House file, section 3 of the Senate file, are similar. And it relates to dismissals of children that are in early learning, early childhood through grade 3. And the Senate has a provision that's not in the House file that limits the ability to remove a class, a student from class, and make sure that the disciplinary dismissal is used in circumstances where the pupil creates immediate and substantial danger. Then section 27 of the House file and section 4 of the Senate file are providing alternative programs, and the language is the same. The differences are the effective dates. Section 28 of the House file and Section 5 of the Senate file are the same, and it's about providing alternative education services for suspended students. Section 29 of the House file, Section 6 of the Senate file are the same, and they're the minimum education services provided when a student is suspended. Section 30 of the House file, Section 7 of the Senate file are the same, about notice for exclusions and expulsions, but they just have different effective dates. Then section 31 of the House file and section 8 of the Senate file are the same, and it's they relate to admission or readmission plans for students who are excluded or expelled from school. Section 32 of the House file, section 9 of the Senate file is also the same. And it's, again, reporting to the commissioner on exclusions and expulsions and student withdrawals. And then section 33 of the House file, section 10 of the Senate file are similar with policies established for around discipline, and I think they also have the different effective dates. Then Section 34 of the Senate House file, excuse me, Section 11 of the Senate file are the same, and it's getting to the portions about prone restraint and physical holds. Section 35 of the House file, Section 12 of the Senate file are required policies and with dismissal and removing students from class. Section 36 of the House file, Section 13 of the Senate file, the same, and it's the policies for discipline and removal of students from class. Section 37 of the House file, Section 15 of the Senate file, the same. And it's, again, about dismissal and removal of students from class and the school supports that are provided. Section 38 of the House file, Section 14 of the Senate file are the same. Again, more discipline and removal from class, and it's a complaint procedure to the school district for the policies. Section 39 of the House file, Section 16 of the Senate file, again, are the same, and it relates to discipline in recess detention at prohibition. Then I think we get to a House file language.
Madam Chair and members, the House section number 40, professional training, the Senate will carry similar language, I think with the same or similar intent. But the House codes this as a new section requiring paraprofessional and certain other district staff paraprofessional and other staff that work with students with disabilities to be provided at least 8 hours of paid orientation or professional development annually, and provides ongoing state aid of $196 times the number of instructional paraprofessionals, and requires that the aid be reserved for the training and orientation. Section 41 is a House-only provision requiring an administrator to consult with a teacher on ways to improve student behavior and enforce expectations of student conduct before the student, when the student's been removed before the student can return to the classroom. Section 42 is pupil application procedures, and the Senate has a similar section in a different article, but this section allows a district to require a non-resident student in an early childhood special education or preschool program other than the VPK or School Readiness Plus to follow application procedures to enroll in kindergarten, whereas the students that are in VPK or School Readiness Plus would be automatically enrolled in kindergarten. The next section is a Senate section.
Okay. And Madam Chair, members, we're at the bottom of page 33 of the side-by-side summary. The Senate's section 1 is actually pulled from Article 8, and it relates to what you're talking about, the House section, and it's an enrollment priority for students who have been enrolled in VPK or School Readiness Plus program for a priority for enrollment into kindergarten. And then Section 2 is of the Senate file is also then pulled from Article 8, and it allows for termination of enrollment for non-resident preschool students that are open enrolled. Section 43 of the House file, Section 15 of the Senate file are the same, and it's enrollment option or the open enrollment program, and about notice to the non-resident school district for attending that school. Section 44 of the House files, Section 16 of the Senate file are different. The Senate file is the definitions for PSEO for an eligible institution, and it adds that an eligible institution must be in compliance with relevant law and judicial decisions.
Madam Chair, members, the House version of that section prohibits a post-secondary institution participating in PSEO from requiring a faith statement during the student's application process or basing an admissions decision based on a student's race, creed, ethnicity, disability, gender, or sexual orientation or religious beliefs or affiliations. Next section, Section 45, is a House-only provision. It requires a post-secondary institution to notify the student's school as soon as practicable if the student withdraws from the course or stops attending. Section 46 is also a House-only provision, requires a high school student in PSEO to provide the high school with the pupil's interim or non-final grades earned during the academic term. Section 47 on that is the same on the House as Section 17 on the Senate side. It shortens the time period for a student to withdraw from a PSEO course, triggering stopping the financial payments. Section 48 on the House and Section 6 on the Senate are similar. This is a new section relating to online instruction. Section 49 on the House side and Section 21 on the Senate side, and we're on page 43 of the summary, is same language relating to a learning year program.
And then, Madam Chair, members, Section 4 of the Senate file is a student safe at school program, which is related to active shooter drills and the parameters around those. Then that gets us.
Oh, I was just going to say, Ms. Lewis, can you clarify where we are then?
Oh, on the side-by-side summary, that was starting on page 44. Several pages long on that one, too. So then that would get us to the top of page 48. And the House file, section 50, and the Senate file, section 3. And those sections are the same, and those are the sections, are the section about full-service community schools. Then section 51 of the House file and section 7 of the Senate file are the same, and they are the it's SLIFE, or the definition of English learners with limited or interrupted formal education. Section 52 of the House file and section 6 of the Senate file are different. It also relates to SLIFE students, but on the House file side, but the Senate has includes pupils with a disability as eligible to participate in the graduation incentives program and in concurrent enrollment courses. Section 53 of the House file and section 22 of the Senate file are the same, and it clarifies the eligibility to participate in ABE. Section 54 is the same as section 16 of the Senate file, and it's the plan implementation for the Achievement and Integration Program. Then we get to page 51 of the side-by-side summary. Language at the bottom is section 55 of the House file and section 23 of the Senate file, and they are the same, and it's about the commissioner's authority withhold revenue. Then on page 52 of the side-by-side summary, it's a Senate-only provision, and it's a grant program for innovative incubator service learning grants. And then we get to page 54 of the side-by-side summary, and it's a similar provision, section 56 of the House file and section 8 of the Senate file, related to special education. And this is where the Senate includes their provision related to paid orientation for paraprofessionals.
Ms. Lewis, if you pause just for a minute. Senator Gustafson, you have a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking for it, and you got to it quicker. I thought I saw a House version had paid training for paraprofessionals in a different section, and we didn't, right? So would those just get reconciled, or?
Madam Chair, and yes, we would, as the staff, once the decisions are made for funding, because there is money related to that, we'd figure out
which would work best, I believe.
Thank you. I just didn't know if I was imagining that. No. Thank you.
You had it right. All right. If you'd like to continue, Ms. Solis.
Madam Chair, it's a house only for residents.
Ms. Pera.
Madam Chair, members, the next few sections are house only. Section 57 on the house modifies the definition of public employee for purposes of the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, which is what governs collective bargaining. So this allows a temporary or seasonal school district or charter school employee to be a public employee for purposes of collective bargaining. Section 58 establishes an ethnic studies working group to advise the commissioner on ethnic studies standards. They would develop the ethnic studies standards, recommend professional learning requirements, resources, and then the commissioner would adopt the working group's standards using expedited rulemaking. Section 59 is a computer science education advancement program. It has several definitions. It requires the department to create a full-time computer science supervisor position to implement a computer science education strategic plan, establishes a working group, and requires the department to develop contract for award grants for teacher recruitment and training. Has requirements for teacher preparation programs, data collection, and rulemaking. Section 60 for the House is similar to Section 8 for the Senate. This is the pilot program allowing participating schools, this is for charter schools, to use an equity-focused framework to assess school performance. Section 61 is a House-only provision. This is the Holocaust and Genocide Education Working Group that would develop resources to implement the Holocaust and Genocide Education requirements. Section 62 is appropriations. Section 63 is a same reviser instruction, renumbering statutory provisions on statewide assessments. Section 64 is the repealer section. And the House repeals a section relating to graduation rates for students with emotional behavioral disorders, the Online Learning Option Act, because that's replaced with a new statute, and the Senate has slightly different.
Yeah, excuse me. Madam Chair, members, the Senate includes a repealer of the requirement for students to do the civics test.
Any questions? All right, let me continue.
Madam Chair, members, that's the end of Article 2.
Okay. So we're at the end of Article 2. I think we will pause and not begin. It looks like we're barely a third of the way through, but we've had, I think, really good discussion. I think it's been really eye-opening to see where we are. We do have those similar ideas and plans where we kind of deviate and where we might be able to adopt each other's legislation or thoughts or ideas. Members, I would suggest that you go back and review what we've talked about today, and if you do have any questions, you can reach out to us for any clarification. I know our nonpartisan staff is very open to responding to those sort of questions, and you can always bring them back tomorrow. We are considering meeting. I think we will plan to meet tomorrow at 8:30 again in the morning, and we'll go as long as we can and just continue this work. I am not going to adjourn this meeting. I will recess it just in case there's an opportunity for us to come back and discuss anything, but we will try to let you all know in a timely manner so you're not just sitting around waiting for us to call you back into committee. And I think that's all I have right now. Anything else, Chair Joachim?
No, Chair Kunish. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you all for the really good discussion and for your areas of expertise. And this meeting is adjourned. Oops, I mean recess. Excuse me. We're in recess.